You know, there are all kinds of interesting people who live right around your neighborhood. Like, oh, the publicist, the rights distribution manager.
Would you look at that? It's People in Your Neighborhood on 95BFM, thanks to APRA AMCOS NZ.
Oh, hi there.
Shh, listen.
Today we are... I just can't stop laughing now. Today we are joined in the studio with by Paul McLaney from Native Tongue Music Publishing.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
And Paul, you are the writer relations manager?
For Native Tongue, yes.
Yes.
Which means I sort of basically liaise with the current roster of New Zealand writers in regards to their existing publishing deals with Native Tongue. And, you know, out and about in the community, sort of chatting with people who want to know more about their intellectual property rights as they pertain to music.
Awesome. Can you please explain to the listeners what music publishing is? It's not music books,
music
as we've
publishing.
Been asked before.
No, it's not the history of Led Zeppelin 4. I always give the same example, which I sort of, like a metaphor that I figured out a wee while back, that it seems to me the best way of explaining it to people who don't quite get it. And it happens to be alcohol related, which probably means it's why people remember. But I always talk about a recording like a glass of wine. And if you think of the recording as the vessel that holds the wine, so the glass is holding the wine. So if I recorded yesterday and you recorded yesterday and Chris Stapp recorded yesterday, then there'd be three more wine glasses, but the wine would still be Paul McCartney's. Mm-hmm. So it's so publishers look after the wine and recording companies and labels look after the glass.
Cool. Can you elaborate on what else publishers do other than just... So this is kind of like part of it is licensing music for like sync, like film and advertising and stuff.
With the wine, so, you know, the publishing copyright is the three main sources of income from publishing are mechanical income, which is from sales of the recording, performance income, which is broadcast like on BFM or on television in cinemas or at live gigs, obviously is a really big one actually. It's quite a lucrative one actually. And then the other one is synchronization, which has sort of become synonymous with the word publishing because everyone thinks that, oh, I want to get into publishing. What they really mean is I want to get into synchronizing the use of my music in film and television advertising and stuff. But outside of that, you know, so the bread and butter of publishing income is really mechanical and performance income because you can forecast that income. You can't forecast synchronization. You might get $1 million in a sync one year and then not make any money, you know, for 2 years. But, you know, if you are a touring act that is regularly playing and you have regular releases and you have radio play, then, you know, that performance and mechanical income is going to generate just normally. Outside of that, it's really sort of helping, you know, writers develop their craft and, you know, set up co-writes or mentoring sessions or even having, you know, people to bounce ideas off. And because publishing is at the heart of or intersects at some, like a crossroads of so many aspects of the music industry, a big thing is sort of being a catalyst for introductions and further relationships within, you know, the scene.
Mm. So in your day-to-day role as writer relations, like what would you do? Would you like meet with an artist and just kind of like mentor them and make suggestions and that sort of thing?
Well, you know, if they're already signed, then it's you know, looking at where they are and currently in their deal. Because when you sign it, if you're like on a full writer deal and you've received an advance and you have a delivery commitment, say of a certain number of songs, it used to be a certain number of albums, but because people are releasing music differently these days, it's generally a number of songs. So there'll be a term, an advance, and a delivery commitment. And where you are at any point in that is where your conversation with the publisher is in terms of what they can and can't do. If, you know, if you're at the beginning of an album cycle and you have an album ready to come out, then obviously getting that out to as many different, you know, opportunities as possible for licensing opportunities and touring and support slots and things with and then if, you know, if they're at the end of that, it's like, well, I'm gonna go away and, you know, write some songs, you know, investigating whether or not there's any fellowships available or if there's certain producers or other writers they'd like to work with to develop their craft. And so, I mean, the main thing at the end of the day, it all comes in a one big Venn diagram, and that big circle would be adding value.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was first starting and publishing over at Mushroom, I always thought that adding value was getting as much money through the door as possible. But pretty soon I realized that adding value is actually, it's also has aspect of protectionism to it. You know, like someone say, "Hey, I really want to use your song in my movie. I've got $100." It's like, great. Well, I want a Lamborghini, but I've only got enough money for a Toyota Corolla. So, you know, and so it's about saying no. And you know, one of the major things about publishers is nothing can happen without writer approval. So you might have a synchronization on the table for like $1 million. There's actually something happened on BFM many years ago when Chris Knox mentioned that he'd been approached for a synchronization for Teagle Chicken.
Yep.
But he's vegetarian, so he turned it down. And somebody was listening, another musician, what name, but was listening. He probably wouldn't mind if I said his name, but he rang up and said, "I'll write something."
Yep.
"I eat chicken." And so, you know, it's about, you know, even if I've actually had a synchronization on the table for like $1 million and the writer just doesn't believe in synchronization, so it just didn't happen. So, you know, the record company were crying, but this guy was, you know, I don't want to do that. So,
well, it's intellectual property, isn't it? It's your craft. So
yeah, well, I mean, the thing about advertising and stuff, especially advertising as opposed to film and television, is that you're sort of lending your goodwill to that product. You know, it's interesting to me that, you know, adverts for bread and milk and things like that in New Zealand and supermarkets are all like songs that have massive integrity, like, you know, the Clean Tally Ho or Chris Knox Not Given Lightly and stuff, because these songs, you know, they're people that have about as much integrity as you can buy in the New Zealand music sector. And so to attach that integrity and that goodwill to, you know, your milk or your bread, it's really what you're buying. And you know, and a lot of car ads and things. You know, if you ever see a car ad on television, it's always like, you know, driving through some beautiful landscape, you know, and it's all about freedom. And, you know, it's not about, hey, look at this car, it's really good at parking in supermarkets and it's got like a really good camera. You know, they don't, it's really about, you know, freedom and the open road and I can go anywhere. And a lot of advertising in New Zealand is really about that narcissistic sense of being a New Zealander. You know, it's all kiwi fruit, pavlova, buzzy bee sort of ideas. So, like, which is great for New Zealand musicians because the first choice is generally, you know, New Zealand music, because that identity of being Kiwi is so important and strong, as it should be. And so, you know, in many instances, a lot of Kiwi artists' sort of payday is one of those big ads, because, you know, you're talking north of 50 grand aside.
Yeah.
You know, for 50 grand for the wine and 50 grand for the glass.
Yeah. And so can you explain, you mentioned the word advance earlier. Can you explain what an advance is? Because it's kind of like a loan, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just it's saying, we think, you know, we're going to sign you for 5 years and we think that in the first 2 years you'll make this much money. So here it is now. You can go and then we'll make it back. And if you know, and a lot of advances these days are based on like what's called a rolling advance. So rather than going really deep, this really deep hole and climbing in, you say, well, let's make it manageable. You know, so we think you will make this much in the first 18 months, so we'll give it to you now. And if you make it, if you do make that back in the 18 months, then we'll give it to you again, if you want it. You know, it's your choice, because people have, you know, tax implications and what have you. But yeah, so it's a show of goodwill. And generally in this industry, as everybody knows, you know, having some sort of cash flow, you know, if you're going to put on a concert, you know, it's going to cost you, you know, a few thousand dollars to hire the venue and the staff and do the posters and pay for the advertising on radio and Phantom and the rest of it. So you're putting, you know, there's a huge risk of investment that you want to make back on ticket sales. So having cash flow is really, really important for how those businesses work as businesses.
Yeah. And can you tell us how you got into the music industry?
How did I get into the music industry? Is this like when I got my first guitar?
You can if you like.
Well, you know, I knew from the age of 13 that was going to be my life, from making music and being creative. And when it got to the end of high school, I got myself down to Otago University, because that's where Strategic Fits and The Chills and, you know, that was a really important musical centre. And I didn't quite realise at the time that what a true university town it is, and probably the only one, you know. So it really is like, you know, the town exists pretty much to host the students. So, I mean, amazing situation. And, you know, when I was down there in the mid-90s, it was you know, there was so many practice rooms and there's so many venues, and, you know, so you could be playing every week and rehearsing three times a week. And, you know, you'd be in your practice room at Vogel House and the 3Ds would be coming through that wall, and, you know, I don't know, Snapper or something would be coming through that way. So it was, you were right in the heart of it from the very beginning. Then you go to the Empire and, you know, Martin Phillips would sit down and start talking to you about Velvet Underground drumming on heroin, how it speeds up. You know, I've really got a vivid memory of him just sitting down talking to me about that, and he's like talking, and I see his lips moving, and go, oh, it's Martin Phillips, wow. Oh, look, there's Graham Downs. Oh my God, there's Sean Carter. You know, so you're living in that space. And I was doing law degree down there. I did psychology and law. I thought psychology for the lyrics, and then law to, because I was very much aware very early on that if I was going to pour blood, sweat, and tears into artistry, then I wanted to know how to look after it. I mean, it's like, it's funny because, you know, in the music industry, there's this idea, oh, I'm just an artist and I'm just going to wander around and wait for my next bolt of inspiration, but I don't really want to look after business and I don't really want to look after that. Whereas it's interesting to me, in hip-hop culture, that's totally the opposite, you know.
Yep.
Jay-Z is lauded for being a businessman as much as he is being, you know, and same with Kanye at his peak. But within that sort of, you know, day-to-day aspect of being a musician, it seems to be, oh, I don't want to care about that. But I always say, like, if you're a guitar player who writes songs, then you should know how to change the strings on your guitar, and you should understand intellectual property because that's what you were making.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing if you're a drummer and you're a writer, you know, you should know how to change a snare head, and you should understand intellectual property because that's what you make. You know, I'm sure upholsterers know where to buy fabric from, and I'm sure
true that.
and you know, and they don't give their chairs away for exposure.
Yeah.
I love that letter that, you know, some restaurant guy wrote a letter to a musician saying, hey, it'd be great exposure for you to come and play at our. And he wrote back saying, I think it'd be really good exposure for you to come round to my house and cook dinner for all my friends.
Yeah, it's crazy how people don't, it's crazy to me, like, until the educator, that they don't understand that they need to license or.
Also, it's a bit like, you know, when you've known someone for quite a long time and you've forgotten the name, and, you know, and it's all, hey, dude. Or, and you get past that point where you feel like you'd be embarrassed to sort of say, hey, I've got no idea what your name is.
Yeah.
Same thing in the publishing thing. You know what? I don't really understand it. Can you explain it to me again? And part of my role within the native tongue is to pretty much have that conversation fair. But can you just explain to me again what mechanicals are? Because is that when you sell something? And I'm like, well, no, that's the publishing share of when you sell something. Oh, you know, because, you know, it's like the English language, you know, it's confusing enough. Without being specific, you know, so like a word like spring, you know, what does spring mean? You know, it's a verb, it's an adverb, it's a noun, it's a pronoun, you know, it's so many different things. And the thing with mechanical and master and all that sort of stuff, and, you know, and it's like this massive sort of space of Venn diagrams where, you know, what performance income, you know, what performance income is generated in so many different ways. So it's basically my job to just keep that information in play and keep that hacky sack up in the air so that people, you know, I go and do these talks at tertiary institutions and stuff about it, and I feel like at the end of the talk, I'm like, oh yes, I totally get it, but I know that everyone's going to walk away going, oh, it can't have been that easy.
Yeah.
And then they confuse themselves again as to what it is. So
I think the wine in the glass analogy is really, really good.
Yeah, in high school it's water in a glass.
Yeah. So you went to Otago.
Yep.
Did a law degree, but you've been writing music. I mean, you've released a lot of albums.
I think it's 20 as of a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, so you've done solo albums.
Yep.
And also the impending iterations.
Yep.
Which we've played before on the show. And your latest one is, well, you've had this going on.
I did two records straight off the bat under my own name. Also with the Avalanche Trio, it was like this sort of, I don't know, Astral Weeks meets 33 sort of thing. Very Dunedin. Recorded in Dunedin, and then I formed the band Gramsci, and that's probably where most people would have known about my musicality first instance. And long story short, that broke up in 2005, and I concentrated on sort of acoustic music, and I did a couple of records, Eden, Dime Side, and then Impending Adorations and various collaborations. There was one came out earlier this year called McLennie and Malik, which was just piano and voice, but that was recorded in 2006. I just make all this music all the time.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm sort of the not a very good advertisement for what you probably should do, because I just follow the muse, you know. Yeah. Like, if I wanted to make that sort of record, then I make that sort of record, and I take any sort of commercial thing off. But in making the new Gramsci album, which has just come out, that really does feel like all of the adventures I've done into acoustic music with my solo stuff, and all the adventures into electronica with Impending Adorations and Imram, and collaborations with, you know, Concord Dawn and Rian and all that sort of stuff. It feels like all of those things have all come back to this one spot where Gramsci is what it used to be to me, where it's like a holding space for all of my musical, and it's not particularly niche. It has aspects of all of those things, whereas each of the other things is very specifically genre-based, whereas this is just a big sort of soup.
So what was the inspiration for Inheritance, which is the name of the album that just came out?
Well, at the beginning of 2019, my New Year's resolution, which I'm not religious in any way, shape or form, but I do take my New Year's resolutions very seriously, sort of sacrosanct. And that one was a long time coming, which was to give up alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Initially for a year, but it's now turned into, I sort of can't really see many reasons to go back to anymore. So it was taking a foot off the gas and then really exploring that, because I made a really strong point of not piking on, you know, social engagements. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's really interesting being at the Silver Scrolls at 4 a.m. and being the only sober person, having really intense conversations. I used to have this thought that drunk people would tell you the same thing a million times because they had forgotten they told you. But what I've come to learn is that it's because you didn't react strongly enough to their amazing piece of information. So you just, you know, be really, really effusive in your responses and you won't hear the same story twice.
I remember that you telling me that, and yeah. I've actually put that into practice. And it's true. If you have a massive, like, whoa!
Oh, that's amazing.
Amazing.
Thank you for telling me that amazing story. Yeah. So is that, and it sort of, and you sort of look at, well, why was I drinking in the first place? You know, and coming from the UK, you know, I moved to New Zealand when I was 12. You know, there's such a culture of that working class sort of drinking thing, and it's definitely true in New Zealand too, within sports and, you know, the Friday night and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, so much of that behavior is inherited, and I started thinking about that, and also this idea of personal mythologies, and think about myth. And, you know, myths are the stories of truths. I was always reminded of that Janet Frame thing. These are truths and memories of truths.
Mm-hmm.
And so, so this idea of, you know, that the enduring myths and legends, like especially within the Greek things, like, you know, Icarus and Narcissus and, you know, Tantalus and Atlas and all those, and those Greek ones are so enduring because all of those people are extremely fallible. Even the gods are extremely fallible, so they're a bit more relatable in terms of human nature, rather than being, you know, these perfect luminous,
yeah,
you know, omniscient beings, which is unattainable. So I was thinking about that and personal mythologies. You know, you grow up in a house and you're always asking your dad or your mum, you know, tell us that story about you and your uncles, or tell us this. And so, and trying to unravel a lot of those and actually own the truth in the story rather mm-hmm. than the myth. And that comes to ideas of self too. So, but you know, the last track on the album, because it's a concept album, I suppose, is that when you have that epiphany at the end and you recognize those inherited traits, some of them are social and some of them are genetic, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of predisposition to certain addictions. You have that epiphany, but then you're still alive and you're still swimming through, and it's just, you're just basically waiting for the next epiphany, you know, and you just keep on moving. You don't solve anything. You just sort of improve, mm-hmm. which is the best thing you can ever hope to do. It's just, you know, and it's interesting, you know, my engagement with the publishing sector and engaging with the community and talking about that sort of stuff is, I find it really important, and I just want to help everybody else improve,
yep.
you know, their understanding of things. So I think fundamentally improvement is something you do with people.
Yes, definitely. I think, yeah, it's better to do it with people. And so the album came out during the kind of lockdown, or just post, right? And so I know that at the time you were looking for new ways of doing things. Can you tell us a bit about the show that's coming out on the 21st of August for Gramsci?
Oh, yeah, I mean, so when the whole... I mean, I woke up one morning and I was working on the World Wearable Arts last year, and, you know, which is a big sort of collaborative exposition of creativity. And I woke up one morning, pretty much that idea for the album was in my head. I hadn't planned to do it. Four of the songs on the record were written that morning, rush of it all. And right from the get go, you know, in this era of streaming and limited media outlets for talking about music or getting the word out, it seemed to me that over the last sort of 10 years, I've been working a lot in theatre, you know, and it seems to me the appetite for theatre and audiences to attend theatre is quite high, and so, you know, most of the plays I worked on, you know, they're always full, you know, the audience is always full and they're engaged, and it seemed to me that the next thing I did musically wanted to be conceptualized as a show from the beginning of it. You know, so I didn't make it as an album that sits alone. It was always meant to be performed and presented, but in an ambitious way, because I think in New Zealand, in many instances, we are separated from the resources that allow us to really explore exposition within shows, within musical performances. You know, people go, oh, David Byrne, that was great. And so, well, of course it was great. He had like 8 months or longer probably to rehearse it with a whole bunch of people who are on full wages so they could dedicate their entire time to doing that. And there, we have what I would call like the sort of mum and dad $2,000 a year Spark Arena ticket buying crowd, you know, who are quite happy to drop $200 on a Tool show or Lenny Kravitz or whoever it is, because they have a conception probably backed up with the experience that sophisticated production values are an import commodity rather than, you know, but the reality is it actually started happening with Silo Theatre's presentation of Brele and their inclusion of John Toogood and Tama Waipara and Julia Deans in that performance. That integrate, that slow coming together of the theatre space and the musical space, which in England and in America has happened for generations. You know, I'm talking about people like Laurie Anderson and David Byrne, and then obviously in the UK, Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel, and what you'd loosely sort of term art rock, or, you know, that sort of more theatrical productions of live performance, rather than, you know, generally what happens is when you get to, like, you know, the venue, San Fran or whatever it is, and you've got 2 hours to sound check and sort out lights, and basically the light show is this one blue or red? And, you know, is this one in 6/8 or 4/4, so I know when to hit the space bar for the blinders. But to really take that time to investigate some of these theatre spaces in terms of what their capacity to present live music is in a different way, that might be a bit more thought-provoking and a bit more engaging. And the magic of theatre is that once the lights go down, then it's a bit like watching a movie. You have that suspension of belief for the period of time that you're in there. And so the gig... That was a long answer, wasn't it? The gig is happening at the ASB Waterfront Theatre because they are the only theatre that I know of that is technically capable of hosting the experience that I want to present.
Yep.
Which involves like gold screens and projections and, you know, theatre lighting. That's the reason it's there. And for me, when I closed my eyes and listened to that record or imagined it before it was even recorded, you know, that's what I was seeing. I didn't see a gig in a bar. And it's interesting to me, you know, I've spent my life in bars, you know, it's probably why I had the concert, you know, the New Year's resolution that I had. But and it's not for it to be the only performance space. So when people say venues in New Zealand, they're talking about, you know, pubs and bars. But, you know, And to a certain extent, for certain musical artists, it sort of ghettoizes the exposition of that art, because, you know, bars are there first and foremost to sell alcohol. So you've got, you know, but, you know, if you went, I can't remember ever going to see a performance of King Lear where the rugby was left on in the corner and someone poured 300 bottles of beer, empty bottles of beer, into a bin during Or Reason Not the Need. You know, it's so in many ways, it's sort of ghettoized. And also, you know, there's a point around audience accessibility, because, you know, as soon as you're playing in a bar, then anybody below the age of 18 isn't allowed access to that space. You know, so you've got some young, amazing guitar player, 12-year-old guitar player or drummer who wants to go and access, you know, the opportunity to see these people doing these things at this level. Then they have to wait another 6-7 years before they're even allowed into the space, which seems bizarre to me. And then you have a whole bunch of people who are over a certain age or have certain health requirements, which means they don't really want to stand for 2 hours in a bar or have someone shouting for 3 more gin and tonics during their favourite song. So, you know, that those sort of performance spaces, those theatre performance spaces, which exist up and down the country, especially now when the borders are closed, if there's ever an opportunity for New Zealand musicians to be more ambitious in terms of the presentation of their music in performance spaces, then now is the perfect time. And it might change some attitudes towards, you know, the competition of artists in that space vying for international, you know.
That's true. And, like, can you also tell us who's in your band?
Yes, I can. I am very lucky to have Greg Haver on drums. So Greg's Welshman by Perth, and is known for his involvement with bands like Manic Street Preachers. You know, he played percussion and has produced records for those guys, and Catatonia, and oh, there's just endless numbers of people. He's on the new Troy Kingy record. He's a very good triangle player. He's a really good drummer. He sounds like John Bonham, but he's also really good on the triangle, which is quite a hard thing to be good at. And Joel Mulholland, who is, you know, without doubt, one of the more talented musicians in this country, you know, and has talented as a producer and as an engineer, but also as, you know, a guitar player and bass player and singer, songwriter. I mean, he's been in most bands.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. And so the show is on the 21st of August
at ASB Waterfront Theatre. All the details are on gramsci.co.nz.
Okay. And where can you get tickets from?
It's all happening. Well, if you link through that site, it will send you to the ASB Waterfront.
Cool.
So yep. The theatre themselves are managing all the tickets. They've been fantastic in terms of taking on this project, because, you know, they don't host a lot of music. You know, the theatre situation, I mean, theatres think of in terms of booking out a week. You know, that's how the psychology of working in a theatre works, whereas, you know, with venues, it's like one night, and that's why, you know, you do have those spaces holding it. Like, but this is an experiment in engaging a musically attentive audience. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big experiment, and they're very well set up and contained to actually be a one-stop shop in terms of, you know, being able to ticket the event and staff the event, and also they have their own tech crews, and then also interfacing with you know, like the College Hills and the rest of the world, in terms of, because, you know, they're set up to do they're not set up to do rock concerts, they're set up to do, you know, Chekhov plays. And
yeah, I'm really excited about the show. I can't wait to see it.
It's pretty ambitious, but that's, you know, I just sort of don't see the point in not being ambitious, especially now.
Yeah.
I mean, it was ambitious before, but this just, the whole situation around COVID and the lockdown, and this really precarious position we're in, where we are one of the few countries in the world where we can actually do these things, and, you know, and the restrictions that went back into place at midnight last night in Melbourne, you know, really do illustrate what a privileged position we're in, and, you know, and long may it last, you know, with the protections that we have. But we should, I mean, if we don't have an artistic renaissance in this country in the next sort of year, then we probably don't deserve one, you know, because the it's a perfect storm of, you know, you can get down and out about things, but I sort of believe in silver linings, and, you know, and finding all those silver linings and stitching them together into some sort of big, you know, tapestry, silver screen thing that we can actually sort of express ourselves and champion and celebrate our unique sense of identity, and, you know, because that's what we do, right? We do it in everything else.
Yep.
We should do it in music.
Thank you so much for coming in today and talking about publishing in Gramsci.
Oh, thank you very much.
We're going to play a track now from Gramsci.
This is my tribute to Robin Guthrie.
I love this one. This is Achilles' Heel. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Do you like Achilles' Heel?
Another friendly face to make life a little richer. People in your neighbourhood on 95BFM. Thanks to APRA AMCOS NZ.